From The Nation magazine, this is Start Making Sense, political talk without the boring parts. I'm John Wiener, and here comes the next financial crisis. Trump has taken credit for the stock market going up. Now that it's going down, does he get credit for that too? Nomi Prinz will comment. Also, remember when Trump said we should get fewer immigrants coming here from what he called shithole countries and more from places like Norway? We'll ask Ann Jones about that. She lived in Norway for a couple of years recently. We'll ask her what might happen if Norwegians actually did come to the United States. But first, let's talk about treason. For that, we turn to Joan Walsh. She's the nation's national affairs correspondent and a CNN political analyst. She's also the author of What's the Matter with White People? Finding Our Way in the Next America. We reached her today in New York City. Joan, welcome back.
Thanks, John. Happy to be with you.
Well, Donald Trump gave a speech to factory workers in Blue Ash, Ohio on Monday, where he complained that the Democrats didn't clap for him during the State of the Union speech. He said, quote, "Shall we call that treason? Why not?" Close quote. Do you think it's treason not to clap for the president?
Of course it isn't. Everyone knows it isn't treason, except maybe Donald Trump. I don't know what he knows. But, you know, it's a new low. I've seen Republicans, and I know Sarah Sanders has said, oh, he was joking. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter for a couple of reasons. First of all, he also called them un-American and said they didn't love our country. So he was going for a very sharp dig. And secondly, he has degraded our language and our sense of justice and the law for 2 years or more. And we can't keep giving him a pass or saying, oh, that's just the president. This man has threatened to lock up his political opponent, Hillary Clinton. He has told the Justice Department to investigate her, to go against her. He has berated his own attorney general, Jeff Sessions, a man who is as right-wing as they come, for not protecting him and for not staying involved with the Russia investigation when it was obvious he had to recuse himself because Sessions lied. So we are seeing a man who, you know, he's a toddler, but he's also an authoritarian. He looks like he would be more comfortable in Vladimir Putin's shoes or in Erdogan's Turkey than running a democracy in the United States.
I want to go back just for a minute to the White House spokesman who said on Tuesday morning that the president was just kidding when he said it was a treason not to clap for him in the State of the Union. We have the clip of Trump's speech. Let's listen.
You're up there. You've got half the room going totally crazy, wild. They loved everything. They want to do something great for our country. And you have the other side, even on positive news, really positive news like that, they were like death and un-American. Un-American. Somebody said treasonous. I mean, yeah, I guess why not? Can we call that treason? Why not? I mean, they certainly didn't seem to love our country very much.
So the White House spokesman said Trump was speaking, quote, tongue-in-cheek. Joan, did it sound to you like that was tongue-in-cheek?
No, it didn't. It sounded like he was agreeing with, I don't know if it was a person in the audience that he heard it from. I don't know, you know, if it was someone else. But he had the opportunity to say, well, treason, that's going too far. I wouldn't do it, you know. But he endorsed it. He said it twice, John. And so, you know, this desire from the White House to periodically give this guy the benefit of the doubt when he has proven time and again that he doesn't deserve it, especially on these questions of civil liberties and freedom. Sarah Huckabee Sanders has zero credibility. She should be ashamed of herself. She goes out there and lies. At least Sean Spicer looked a little bit embarrassed, like yes, sometimes he knew he was lying.
Yes, he did, didn't he?
She's brazen.
Well, now for something else. According to the New York Times on Tuesday, Trump's lawyers do not want him to sit down for an interview about his Russia dealings with special counsel Robert Mueller. His lawyers are, quote, concerned that the president has a history of making false statements, close quote. Does that mean Trump's lawyers think he's a liar?
That's pretty much what it means, yes. He has a history of lying, and they know it, and they don't feel that he could even control himself long enough to sit down with Robert Mueller. It's a really astonishing thing. I've heard people refer to this as that Mueller is setting a perjury trap for the president. There's no such thing as a perjury trap. Go in, tell the truth. You can't perjure yourself if you're telling the truth. There's a lot of concern that he doesn't know what other people have already testified. That's the way these investigations work. But if you tell the truth, you'll be okay. So it would seem to suggest that he either can't or won't tell the truth, that the truth is incriminating, and his lawyers have now overruled him, or most of his lawyers.
I just want to point out, Trump has said he wants to do it. Maggie Haberman writes in the Times, Trump's penchant for bravado has been a factor that his lawyers must contend with. The president has bragged to some aides that he would be able to clear himself if he just talked to Mr. Mueller's team, quote, I'm looking forward to it, actually, Trump told reporters at the White House last month. So what do you make of that?
He's delusional. I don't know if he believes what he's saying there. Honestly, John, I'm comfortable calling him a liar because he does lie so often, but we also have to acknowledge that sometimes he's delusional. So he might have moments where he feels like he would be in the clear, where he feels like whatever he did, he was entitled to do it. So I don't know who to believe here, except to believe the Times reporting that his lawyers think it's a bad idea because they know that he is not going to help himself and that he may very well lie. And unlike certain lies, his lies would be caught because the Mueller investigation has gone so deep and so broad. So I think they're right to be worried. It's appalling that Republicans like Chris Christie, who was once a prosecutor, and Newt Gingrich, I expect nothing from him, are defending the president in case he decides not to talk to Mueller. It's outrageous. Bill Clinton did it. He had to do it. It wasn't pleasant for him. But there's a precedent here. And, it'll be very interesting to see if the president has to be forced.
And the precedent on the other side, of course, is Richard Nixon refusing to cooperate with prosecutors when they requested the White House tapes. That, of course, went to the Supreme Court and led to a constitutional crisis that culminated with Nixon resigning. If Trump refuses to meet with Mueller, of course, it would prompt accusations that the president has something to hide, that would spur the special counsel on to further inquiries. The November elections are not that far away, so the risks for Trump are pretty great here.
It's a very bad look for Trump if he doesn't talk to Mueller. So we have to assume, if he doesn't, that the consequences of talking to him are worse, whether political consequences, legal consequences, or probably both. It's a very, very difficult case to make. It will hurt Republicans up and down the ticket. People will be even angrier with him than they are. If he does it, it will be to save his skin and not the party's. And it will, it will separate some Republicans from the president. I've predicted that so many times since elected, John, and it just hasn't happened. I don't really know what it would take. But it would be an awful moment and one that we may nonetheless see very soon.
Well, now it's time for your Minnesota moment. That's news from my hometown of St. Paul. Michelle Bachmann is not going to run for the Senate seat vacated by Al Franken. A couple of weeks ago, she announced she had asked God whether she should run. And she said over the past weekend, quote, it became very clear to me that I wasn't hearing any call from God to do this, close quote. This means God did not want Michelle Bachmann in the Senate. Shouldn't that be headlines?
I think she's such a marginal character at this point, and would have had so small a chance of winning even the nomination that it didn't register because nobody was worried about it. For agnostics, for those of us who believe in God, it's a good time to say thank you, God. but for other people, I think it's just another laughable moment in the annals of the increasingly irrelevant Michelle Bachmann.
Can we talk for a minute about your move from MSNBC to CNN? It all happened on December 24th. MSNBC told you they were not renewing your contract. You had been a contributor there for 12 years, and Twitter went crazy. You are the first person I ever knew who was actually trending on Twitter. Hashtag keep Joan Walsh. Chris Hayes and Joy Reid tweeted support for you, and by that evening, CNN had hired you. What was the whole thing like for you?
It was surreal. It was not quite the 24th, but it was the Friday before Christmas that they told me they weren't going to renew my contract. That was the 22nd. And yes, within 24 hours, CNN had made me an offer. And yes, in the intervening hours, I had never seen myself trend either. And it was mind-blowing. I was getting ready for a dinner party that Saturday night. I was trying to stay off Twitter. My daughter was trying to keep me off Twitter. She was taking pictures of me and posting them to Twitter, saying things like hashtag keep Joan Walsh peeling potatoes, keep Joan Walsh cleaning the kitchen, reminding me what I was supposed to be doing and not, you know, obsessing on social media, which was really helpful. And I just am incredibly grateful for the outpouring of support. You know, we can't complain about Twitter. It does terrible things. It's got a terrible bot problem. It doesn't deal with either Russian bots or real live Nazis as well as it should. But I've been on actively for almost 10 years. I do have a following, and I think that MSNBC's decision, partly coming before Christmas, and also I think letting go of a progressive woman of a certain age at a time when the resistance is female, there's a real perception of the lack of women in high places in media. It's getting better, but it's still not good. We've had revelations of sexual harassment in the industry, which we know has thwarted the careers of many women. So I think there was a real sense of protection of me among women, some of whom know me and spoke out on my behalf, and some of whom only know me from TV but think that I was treated unfairly. And so it had a happy ending. I love CNN. I'm having a great time.
Joan Walsh, watch her on CNN, read her at thenation.com. Thanks, Joan. It's always great to have you on the show.
Thanks, John.
Next up, here comes the next financial crisis. For that, we turn to Nomi Prinz. She's the author of 6 books, including All the President's Bankers. And her writing has been featured in The New York Times, Mother Jones, The Guardian, Tom Dispatch, and The Nation, among others. Nomi Prinz, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, Trump for months has been taking credit for the stock market going up. And of course, there's nothing surprising about Wall Street being happy with lower taxes and less regulation. But this week, the stock market went down. Does Trump get credit for that, too?
Well, Trump has been surprisingly tweet quiet since the stock market went down by about 2,000 points between Thursday and Monday. I think he, there are things that might actually shut him down for a minute. He's not taking credit for the downside. He did certainly take credit for the upside, and if the markets go back up, I'm sure he will be back again to take credit. But the reality is the markets are indicative of not the real economy, but the level of capital that's available for the most part to the speculative classes. I mean, there is a percentage of other types of citizens who have some money in it. But for the most part, the bigger movements tend to happen because there's capital available to the more speculative groups of companies and individuals and so forth. And that's what has been pushing the stock market up high, not just under Trump, but also President Obama since the financial crisis in 2007-2008.
So the stock market goes up and down. What's the scenario for the next big crash? How might it start? What might it look like?
So here's what happened since the financial crisis. The Federal Reserve stepped in and ensured that interest rates, got down to zero. And that was predominantly, although it was termed as to be helpful to the real economy, in reality, it was the largest private banks that have regular access to the cheapest money. So if rates are zero, they pretty much have access to 0% interest rate money. They turn around and, of course, don't use that same lower level for, you know, providing mortgages. I mean, of course, they did lower to some extent, or providing credit card interest rates being lower and so forth. What they tend to do is use it for speculative purposes. And so the availability of what turned out to be $4.5 trillion worth of cash from the Federal Reserve ultimately went into the markets. It wasn't just the Federal Reserve, which was the U.S. central bank. It was a global coordination of major central banks that did the same thing. So global capital money was rendered very cheap by central banks. They added additional cash into the system because they just manufactured it. And all of that had the result of giving the largest banks and the largest corporations money to spend, which they did on their own shares and in the stock market. So the unraveling of that is how you get the next financial crash. If the money in the stock market has come to the market by artificial collaboration and different types of means, then that money it's not real. It's not long-term. It is temporary. The other pillar of what happened that didn't just put that artificial money into the stock markets was that we created, i.e. we, the powers that be, created a tremendous debt bubble. So both in public debt and the debt that governments issue in order to supposedly finance their economies, but in this case it went towards basically weighing down corporations who borrowed it cheaply. The bigger you are, the cheaper you get money. Whether you are a bank or whether you are GE or whether you are Apple, it's easier to borrow money more cheaply when it is available if you are bigger. So all of those companies, as well as governments, borrowed money at these cheap rates, so that created a debt bubble. A financial crisis tends to start with a debt bubble popping, and then it very quickly moves on to a stock bubble popping, and stock markets tend to go down more quickly from higher heights than debt does, simply because they trade more quickly. It's a lot easier to buy and sell stock than sometimes it is to buy and sell bonds. And so the financial crisis that would happen is because all of this starts to unravel, because in reality, it wasn't based on real growth or real investment or real solid foundational economics.
We have a bunch of government regulatory institutions whose purpose is to protect us from the unraveling that you're describing. Let's talk about the safeguards and how they are supposed to work.
So in theory, the Federal Reserve, which I just spoke about having basically plenished the banking system, which then created all this debt and stock bubbles around it, is supposed to, as one of its day jobs, regulate the banking system. Technically, it was created, or at least some of the language was created, to enable it to have that supreme regulatory power over the banks. In practice, what has happened, not least because it was created to help the biggest banks when it was established in 1913 by the Federal Reserve Act, is that it tends to not be able to do that very well. So when we had the financial crisis in 2007-2008, the Fed was completely asleep at that wheel. In fact, Ben Bernanke, who was the chairman of the Federal Reserve at the time, was going about saying that the housing problems that were basically visible to any really good journalist or economist who is paying attention to the figures that actually were also in the books of the Federal Reserve. So these were not even secretive figures. There were problems in the housing industry, which meant there were problems in the assets that the banks created on the back of the housing industry's mortgages, which they basically proliferated throughout the world. And when those fell, the whole market crashed. The Fed wasn't good at noticing that. It wasn't good at doing anything about it. And this time's no different. The only difference is that instead of dealing just with mortgage-related securities at the residential level, people's mortgages, there's much more commercial mortgage problems that will be coming in because of all of this cheap borrowing and because commercial borrowers were able to borrow more and at better rates than at this time around individuals could. And also that these corporate bubbles and these government bubbles, which I was speaking about before, the Fed is supposed to be watching that. And it's supposed to be able to regulate the banks that are involved in that. The other institutions or entities in Washington that are supposed to be looking at this stuff are the Securities and Exchange Commission, whose job it is, among other things, to ensure that the securities that trade in the public marketplace, which are related to banks and major corporations and anyone who is able to trade their stocks or their debt in the corporate marketplace, are not imbued with fraud. So instead of what happened in the wake of the last financial crisis, of fining all these institutions after the fact, after they've committed the fraud, technically the SEC is supposed to be ahead of that game and to watch for things that will accumulate. The other sort of newer institutions or entities are the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which was created in the wake of the financial crisis of 2007-2008 under the Dodd-Frank Act of 2010. That was a big push by Elizabeth Warren and other senators who thought it would be good. Even though technically this was part of the Federal Reserve's job to watch to make sure the banks were regulated properly so that they didn't screw over actual consumers and people, that there should be a separate entity, and it is in fact funded under the Federal Reserve's umbrella, that would specifically watch for problems that could hurt consumers or also help to navigate problems that already occurred against consumers and help to get some of their money back. So those are some of the entities that exist that are supposed to be protecting us and the economy in general from reckless banking and other types of market behavior.
So what we've seen in the last week is just a little hint of how fragile the markets can be. Nevertheless, Trump's deregulation is going full speed ahead. How fragile are the markets at this point, do you think?
Well, given the fact that a lot of the growth, or what I think is the bubble filling of the markets, has taken place on the back of artificial means, on the back of these central banks working to ensure that there's enough cheap money for the financial system and its, you know, sort of corporate clients to exist and to buy their own stock and issue more debt and all the things that create a bubble. That's not an inherently stable market situation. That's not the same as real growth. It's not the same as a company growing because it's investing in its people or it's building, a new plant or there's infrastructure development happening or that sort of thing. And so it's not an inherently stable environment. So if you add that to, for example, what's happening with the Trump administration, which are all the entities that are supposed to be monitoring or regulating or ensuring the stability, the safety of the entire system for the rest of us, are wanting to instead dismantle whatever rules currently exist. And so that every person who Trump has appointed and the Senate has approved to run these different areas is a self-proclaimed deregulator. Who doesn't want to have more rules for banks, but to have less. Stephen Mnuchin, who is the Treasury Secretary, has gotten rid of, for example, certain reporting requirements just for us to know what's going on with some of the more systemically, risky types of institutions in the mix. And so they're not really trying to engender safety around the system. They're trying to do exactly the opposite. So if you add an unstable system that has been artificially stimulated to a pack of people whose job it is to ensure stability but who are doing the exact opposite in total dogma, then and have the power to affect those sorts of changes, So does Congress, but it depends on the entity that they're in charge of, whether things go through Congress or doesn't. That becomes a just toxic sort of mess.
One last thing. You had an interesting life before you became a journalist. Tell us about that.
Well, I actually worked at four of the biggest banks in the world, two of which actually no longer exist, Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns, which went belly up during the financial crisis, were not saved by their relationships with Washington. People in Washington, for example, Hank Paulson, who had been the CEO and chairman of another bank I worked for, a little institution called Goldman Sachs, was in Washington helping to save Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase, for example. I had started work in my career on Wall Street at Chase when I was 19 out of college. And so I kind of did the gamut of the larger investment bank and commercial bank institutions before Glass-Steagall was repealed, during, after, when the euro was created, basically throughout all of a really interesting time of just financial change in the world and sort of the power increase of these institutions. And then I quit around the time when there was a lot, well, after 9/11. And now I've been using that, towards journalism and writing books and, hopefully illuminating the sort of dark side of the financial system for people that, didn't necessarily have that experience on the ground.
Nomi Prinz on the dark side. Her new piece at thenation.com is titled, "Here Comes the Next Financial Crisis. Trump's deregulators are setting the economy on fire." Nomi, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you, John.
We're still thinking about Donald Trump's question about immigration. Remember when he said, "Why are we having all these people from shithole countries coming here?" Followed by his suggestion that the United States should admit more immigrants from places, he said, like Norway. For comment on that, we turn to our Norway correspondent, Ann Jones. She's a journalist and author whose works include the unforgettable book Kabul in Winter. She's also the author of War Is Not Over When It's Over, both from Metropolitan Books. And her latest book is called They Were Soldiers, How the Wounded Returned from America's Wars, The Untold Story. Ann Jones, welcome back.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with you in Norway. You have what we call standing to talk about this.
I think so. I lived in Norway for continuously for 4 years. It was my refuge. You mentioned some of the books I've written about Afghanistan, about other war zones where I've worked, about being embedded for a time with American forces to observe the injured and how the injured and wounded soldiers are evacuated and treated. I had had many years of experience with warfare, and frankly, I needed some R&R, and I applied for a Fulbright fellowship to Norway, which thankfully they gave me, and I went on that brief fellowship and liked it so much that I just stayed on for several years because I needed, frankly, to live in a peaceful, happy place after being through way too much violence in the years before. So that was my recovery. I loved it there, and I loved it because of the way Norway has put itself together, because of its politics and the governance that it has managed to create for the good of all the citizens, and also for their visitors, I might add.
Well, there haven't been any signs that Norwegians want to emigrate to the United States, but you write in The Nation that if a mass of Norwegian immigrants did show up here, it would pose a genuine threat to Donald Trump's America. What kind of threat are you talking about?
Well, an ideological threat, a threat of politics and governance. The reason that it's unlikely that many Norwegians would want to come to the United States, to emigrate to the United States, is that they are year after year ranked at the top of the list of happiest countries on earth. And it is because of their particular political and economic organization. This is a topic that Bernie Sanders tried kind of unsuccessfully to discuss in the Democratic debates in the last election. And it got kind of dismissed because Norway is a small country, something like 5.2 million people. But there are big lessons to be learned from there. And I think the biggest one is the importance of equality in maintaining a democracy. Norway makes real efforts through restraints upon capitalism, cooperative restraints on capitalism in Norway, to make capitalism work for all the people. They redistribute the wealth for the good of all the citizens. In the tax bill our government just passed, we redistribute the wealth upward continuously, so that we are now the most unequal country in the developed world. Well, if you don't tax your wealthy citizens, you don't have the money to do anything for your country. But the Norwegians take exactly the opposite approach by using their system of taxation to on a progressive tax system to tax all the working people in the country, and they're usually at full employment. That tax money then is systematically redistributed to a universal public welfare system, and that includes education, health care, services for the elderly, the disabled. It includes affordable housing, great transportation. It includes all those things that are missing in American life and that make Americans so anxious all the time about how they're going to pay for this, how they're going to pay for that. In Norway, the government has your back all the time, and it leaves people free to do with their lives what they enjoy doing, to work at what they enjoy doing without a question of, can I make enough money? It allows them to start a business if they want to, much more easily than an American can, because if you start a business and a business fails, you still have health care, your kids still have their guaranteed college education. You know, you can try something else.
So all Norwegians have the right to universal public health care, universal public education through university or beyond. They have universal care of the elderly and disabled. They have paid parental leave for mothers and fathers. They have subsidized early childhood education from age one. They have affordable housing. They have state-of-the-art public transit. They've got a lot of other things to take, as you say, take the anxiety out of daily life. But how do they pay for this? Well, my Republican friends would say the Norwegians are lucky enough to have North Sea oil. North Sea oil makes Norway rich. We don't have North Sea oil, and therefore what exactly?
Well, we keep saying that about the oil, and that is a good excuse for not paying attention to Norway. They are just lucky they have all that oil. But in fact, that's not what pays for their universal systems. All that oil money, and it has been very substantial, goes into a sovereign wealth fund saved for the future, saved for future generations. That sovereign wealth fund is now the largest one in the world, and last year it topped $1 trillion, and it's still rising. But it is controversial. It has always been controversial in Norway because Norwegians are such strong environmentalists. So now with the drop in oil prices and oil production, Norway has been phasing out of North Sea oil. They'd be happy to get out of it, actually, because they care so much about the environment. But in any case, as I said, they save that money for the future. And what pays for their welfare system is the taxes of the working citizens. There's absolutely no reason why that kind of taxation system can't be adopted by a country of any size. It is absolutely crazy that we continue to have a tax system that further enriches small group of the population and diminishes everyone else and leaves us without the money to provide even for the most basic improvements in our own infrastructure. This is crazy.
You have one other amazing fact about North Sea oil in your report in The Nation. You say the Norwegian Ministry of Finance calculated in 2016 that the labor of women added to the net national wealth a value equivalent to the country's total petroleum wealth created by North Sea oil. What is the lesson here?
The lesson here is equal pay for women and men. When women went in force into the workforce in Norway, particularly in the 60s and the 70s, and continuing ever since, the vast majority of women in Norway are employed. They were employed at wages very close to those of men, and they've been working ever since to make those wages absolutely equal. That, in fact, doubles the money that the government takes in on the tax rolls. So it's that added income to the nation coming from the taxes of women in the workforce that has really made the difference in being able to fund the universal welfare state. And it has been, according to the Ministry of Finance, worth much more to the country than the wealth that they've gained through oil. In the years I lived in Norway with a residence permit to be there, I received all of those benefits myself. I experienced them all myself. And I talked earlier about needing to recover from the anxiety of being in war zones. I recovered also from the anxiety of being in the United States. It's a very peaceful life in a country where you feel secure. And I had the real privilege of experiencing that firsthand.
Ann Jones, she wrote about the Norwegian menace for thenation.com. Thank you, Ann, and as they say in Norway, tusen takk.
It's my pleasure, John. Thank you very much.
Finally, a word about Dave Zirin's Edge of Sports podcast, where sports and politics collide, hosted by the sports editor of The Nation, and featuring Dave Zirin's interviews, his commentary, and his rants. So even if you're a sports fan who hates politics, or a political junkie who hates sports, you'll find something to love in this podcast. It's posted every Tuesday, now at thenation.com/edgeofsports. Start Making Sense, The Nation podcast, is co-produced by the LA Review of Books and recorded at the studios of Emerson College, Los Angeles, located in the heart of Hollywood, with technical assistance from Justin Allen. Our show is recorded and edited by Lyra Smith. Alan Minsky is our senior producer. Frank Reynolds is our executive producer. Annie Shields is our engagement editor. Katrina Vandenhoevel is editor and publisher of The Nation. Our theme music is from Barcelona Afrobeat, licensed by Creative Commons. Find out more about Start Making Sense at thenation.com and subscribe to Start Making Sense at iTunes, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm John Wiener. Tune in to Start Making Sense next week for more political talk without the boring parts.